Welcome back to the Ink Sink. I am Annie.
I'm Kaylee.
And this is our books and literature podcast for the rest of us. I took it to a different direction that time.
Yeah, you did. Hey, you know what? We're keeping it fresh.
That's right. Yeah. You never know what you're going to get on the Ink Sink. We're like...
just a ton of surprises on our publishing.
Yep.
That's niche right. Podcast.
That's right. Books. Fascinating.
That's true.
Constantly changing.
That also true, actually.
How you doing, Kaylee?
I'm good. I'm tired, but I'm prepped. You know, we're recording this. We've got the holidays coming up.
Yeah.
I have time off booked, and nice. I'm going to be leaving my work laptop behind.
So yeah, you are. Good. Go get them.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. Yeah, so things are going well. How are you, Annie?
I'm also doing well. Excited for the holidays. We're recording this the week before Thanksgiving, so it's going to be really, really nice to have a break
yes.
from work. It is. And we've got our little Trixie here. She's a good dog. Hi, Trixie.
She's the cutest. She's a cute little pupper. Dog.
And she's like, no, I'm Mom.
I'm hungry.
I'm a dog who loves check-on. Yeah, you did a grumble. We all heard it. My dog is part husky, so she just likes to grumble at things. So, Kaylee, before we jump all the way in, I do want to issue a couple corrections. In our book bans plus book business episode, which I think I titled something like Spaghetti on Walls, I said that in the next episode that our listeners would hear, we would be talking more about book bans. And then when I was editing the next episode, I took the book ban section out. So
we did not talk about book bans. Surprise.
Sorry, everybody.
We were just sad because it was basically all of the same thing, pretty much. Yeah. It usually is. Like, we'll give you another update and it'll be like, and then this is still happening.
Pretty much.
So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, for the record, that section was pretty short and it didn't have anything that you didn't already know about, essentially, in it. But I did promise it and I did take it out. So I did have to apologize really quickly to everyone. Also in that episode, I said that Penguin Random House was owned by a private equity company and that they might be shopping around the company soon. That is not true. I was getting companies mixed up. It was Barnes & Noble that I was thinking of that's owned by another private equity company. Penguin Random House is owned by Bartlesman, which is not a private equity company. Anyway, basically everything I said after that doesn't mean anything or make any sense because I was totally wrong about what company I was talking about. So let's just like pretend that didn't happen.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so unlikely that Penguin Random House and Simon Schuster would be looking for a new buyer anytime soon. That would be silly because it's not owned by a private equity company. Thank you for listening.
End.
And scene. Kaylee, we're talking about cookbooks today. Are you excited?
I am. It's funny. I actually attended, I dragged my husband, my future husband at the time, to an immersive semi-edutainment thing about consumerism in the 1600s. And it was including recipe books and such like that, like cards and stuff, food and how we consider food as a people and how it's kind of grown over time.
Interesting.
So it was an interesting, it colored probably my approach to some of the research that I did. In general, obviously, we kind of chose this topic due to, you know, the surge of themed novels. And I think we each, obviously, as we always tend to do, went in wildly different directions for our research. So it'll be very interesting. Like, again, I just want to be clear, we don't coordinate that. It just happens because the parts that are similar, but then the parts that are different are very different amongst us.
Did you mean themed novels or themed cookbooks just now?
Both.
Both. Okay. What's a themed novel? What does that mean?
So within the genre, like romance or crime, where the way that the plot is either tied to or influenced heavily, like specifically by food or by the...
Like a food-themed book.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
So, and I talk a little bit about that, or at least I will talk a little bit about that. That's part of in my topic, probably, that like why and how this kind of can influence or speak to the plot and the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of my research.
Cool. I am excited to hear about that. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we went in wildly different directions. So normally when we decide on a topic, we're like, it's pretty small and we're just like, we can probably figure out most of the stuff to do with this. Cookbooks are such a massive topic. I'm sorry to everyone if we don't get to your favorite part of cookbooks or your favorite cookbook. We can't do that in a single episode. We went and researched some of our favorite parts about cookbooks, we will absolutely have another episode about cookbooks for sure. And if you have like a particular favorite cookbook or a particular favorite genre of cookbooks, please send it in, inksyncpodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear what our listeners do with their cookbooks, or like what your favorite type of cookbook is. What was the last one you like had to buy? I want to know.
Yeah, that would be really interesting because there are some super interesting and cool ones. And in some of the articles that I read, like a person's like cookbook shelf is always so interesting. And despite the fact that we have access to the internet now, we still continue to buy cookbooks. For a variety of reasons, not least of which is you don't have to go through 37 pages of Nana's immigration from one country to the next to get to the recipe about like how to boil an egg, right? Or whatever.
Yeah.
Like the soft, like the three step, like you're just, how long do I need to cook chicken at this particular temperature?
Right.
Anyway.
No shade to the bloggers. If that's their like main way that they make money is by hitting those word counts. No shade to you all, but it is a known annoyance.
Like we all know. I'm sorry. And like, you know, also as a blogger, you've been hit by this later. Like
yeah.
in this, when you're trying to find something else for a recipe, you've been irritated by that before.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the jump to recipe button didn't just pop out of nowhere.
Oh yeah. The button fairy didn't just come and visit all of the pages on the internet, for sure.
You knew it was a problem when you put that button in there. Let's start with history.
Sure.
You went a little bit further back than I did. I went to about as far back as the 1800s, but you went even further than that.
I did.
At least at the museum, you went to the 1600s, but then in general, you did more research than that. Tell us about the history of cookbooks.
I did. So I do want to say that the program that we attended was actually at the Shakespeare Library in D.C.
Oh, cool.
And it was in conjunction.
How thematic.
I know, right? And it was in conjunction with Third Rail Projects, who is, they're a very, you know, good immersive theater company that's based out of New York. And they do several installations that are based on not just entertainment, but education as well in many cases. So they've, mm-hmm. they've done several things on that sort of vein in various areas. And I just got really lucky that they were in DC. That was actually several years ago. So it's funny how things go. So I will say that some of the information that I referenced, at least initially, came from the Semmel Healthy Campus Initiative, but it was not a peer-reviewed publication. It was well-researched, and I could track down and confirm a lot of the facts. So I just want to confirm that this is not a peer-reviewed paper. It's more of a blog post, and I'll have the link for that, and of course, in our show notes. So the first like Western cookbook, and to be fair, this is a bit of a Western-centric podcast. You know, obviously, we're U.S., but in this case, it's just that's what we have a lot available to us to discuss. Was actually published in probably 1700 BC.
Wow.
To be fair. And it's on some clay tablets in ancient Mesopotamia, but obviously we don't have a lot from back then.
Right.
What we actually know of in general is that by the 1300s, cookbooks were more normalized within the upper class, so within the nobility. We actually have a 1390 form of curry, which is the Rules of Cookery, which is the translation, essentially, which was published for King Richard II. It has been digitized and is available for access from the Library of Congress, so I will also provide that link.
I think it's definitely in the public domain if it was published in the 1700s.
Sure was.
So that's good news.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can definitely, you know what, somebody's going to make a horror movie out of it pretty soon, I'm sure. God. So what does that matter? So, I mean, obviously, food, especially back, you know, in that time, was a show of wealth. You were showcasing your ability to source these difficult to receive ingredients, and you know, travel, transport, it was all a lot harder back then. Every month was the ever given, you know, block in the Suez Canal as far as the difficulty of getting content from one place to another place. There's always something going wrong. There was pirates and bad weather that we couldn't predict or navigate around or find or, you know, didn't know was coming. So you have these wealthy people who are going probably more elaborate than they needed to within their households, and cookbooks that were initially designed for them. So you'd have like these extensively like elaborate recipes that called for very expensive ingredients that weren't available. The books themselves were difficult to produce, as at that time it was pretty much handwritten sort of deal.
In the 1700s?
In this case, it was the
1390s. Oh, okay.
was what was I was discussing.
Okay.
So you know, initially as, you know, as things developed and once mass production came about, then that's when cookbooks became more readily available for the middle and lower class. But you would still have a very clear class delineation. So you'd have, like, you know, titles in French that would be clearly targeted for the nobility versus, like, the plain cooking guide for the working wife, you know, like, and I'm not actually, I think I added an ing to that title. That was genuinely a title from one of my articles that I read. So we've had a complicated relationship with food as our people have developed because of that, like because consumerism, and how do you justify, like, these elaborate, like, meals where you're, again, eating till you vomit and then continuing to eat while people are literally, that are starving, are literally staring down at you enjoying the view of, I don't know, I can't imagine being in that position where,
I mean, being a servant in a rich person's house, anything that I read about any time before, I don't know, I guess indoor appliances happened when everyone just had servants all over the place, just, it baffles me how they didn't just fly into a rage constantly.
Oh my God, right?
Just being like, what are you doing?
Like, I feel like there were so many reasons why so many revolutions have happened. This is food scarcity, and this control of food has definitely been in the top three of all of them. And must be, I mean, in my opinion, but...
Yeah, I was reading an Agatha Christie novel, and, like, some of the shit that those servants were putting up with just from just, like, some bored gentry. And I'm like, why don't you just punch that person?
Well, Annie, that's...
How do you stop yourself?
So, speaking of, so I swerved to focus on less enraging things, which is my initial...
Good, probably,
like,
a good thing.
My initial focus for it was, like, I could really dive into the classist undertones behind cookbooks in the history of cookbooks before mass, you know, production helped us get to a slightly better place, or I could focus on modern times and cooking in fiction, which is slightly less problematic, and, like, why that has really, you know, sort of started, like, gaining traction when it did and has really blown up lately.
Do you want to take a quick detour before we jump into the modern age with some of the things that I was able to dig up?
I would love to. Please go.
So, speaking of the history and speaking of servants, even, there's a really interesting study from the Innovative Approaches in Engaging People with Local History and Genealogy from the IFLA. There was a presentation from Jennifer Brannock, who works at the Special Collections in the University of Southern Mississippi in Mississippi. And their report was on cookbooks as local history and genealogy sources. And it was absolutely fascinating. They outlined a project that they were doing of collecting community cookbooks and also cookbooks just from the Southern Mississippi area, and how you can actually chart the civil rights movement in the attributions of the cookbooks or attributions of the recipes. So, like, for a long time in the era of slavery, when someone contributed to a cookbook, it didn't matter who developed it. It was attributed to whoever ran that household. And that, like, became a problem, obviously, because it wasn't true. And then she was able to try, or they were able to track how, like, at a certain point, it was also just acknowledged that this came from a housekeeper or a slave in that household, or after the emancipation, you can see, like, this came from a servant in this household, and here is their name, here's their full name, and then you start to see people's recipes being attributed under their full names, just themselves, like, not where they're working or anything else. And it was really fascinating that they were able to track that through cookbooks, because that's an everyday thing. Like, you're talking about how back in the day, pre-printing press, pre-like democratization of books in general, these things were for rich people, and these things were aspirational, and these things were just about, you know, showing off to your friends, and here's the best way to do that. And then it became for, like, regular people who were like, I bet someone else knows something about cooking that I don't know. Let me look it up. And I thought that that was really fascinating, because obviously, you know, one of the things that we're not saying is just that food is so important to so many people for so many reasons, beyond just the you need it to survive bit. Like, you need food to survive, obviously, but also you kind of, you want food to nourish your soul too. Like, there's so much nostalgia wrapped up in food and how you were being fed and what recipes you're using. Like, to this day, I have no idea if, like, the enchiladas that my mother's makes are more or less authentic than anyone else's, but they're the ones that make me the happiest because I have such good memories of them being fed to me over the years because they're delicious. They're all very good. And I thought that that was absolutely fascinating, and I loved that they were able to kind of think that through to make that project work. Another thing that I found from the 1800s and moving forward is something called food fake lore. And this is from JSTOR. I thought this was really funny, actually. You'll see that most of my research was just because was just into things that I thought were really funny. Have you ever heard the story of how the original potato chip was created? How there was a very demanding customer who said, your roasted potatoes are far too thick and far too chewy. They're just not cooked right. And so this person was like, fine, F you. And just like cut them as thin as they possibly could and deep fried them to be the crispiest thing that they could make them. And then served it to this like horrible customer who was like, oh, you should make more of these, you know? Had you heard that story before?
No, I had not heard that story.
I had heard that story with, like, details changed before, but it's fake. It almost definitely didn't happen. Like, the names and dates attributed to the details of that story change throughout, you know, the telling, but most people are like, yeah, that almost certainly didn't happen. They also go through the history or the alleged origin story of Oysters Rockefeller.
Yeah. Next Girl's Night
Plant. Sorry, no. Clams Casino.
Oh, I don't think I've had that.
Was the other one. It just looks like Oysters Rockefeller because those are very large clam shells. My fault. So this is Clams Casino. And like it has a similar story of just a snobby customer coming in and being like, I want this specific thing and you guys, you definitely can't do it. And then like a frustrated chef being like, watch me. And them serving this now iconic dish. And again, most of the researchers say that's not true, but I really love it. Was just super charming, the idea that people just make up stories. Like today we have those enormously long blog posts. I don't know about you, but every now and then I have wondered if any of what they're saying is true.
You know, I honestly couldn't imagine putting that much effort into it, but maybe you're right. Maybe it is just, again, it's like a Dickensian, like, mm-hmm. I need to hit a word count to get paid. And like, so they're going to manufacture their grandmother, like, who hauled eggs from New York to Boston so she could make the special, like, custard recipe.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That I'm now, like, we can now just do and store bought's fine.
Right, exactly. If you can't get, you know, eggs hand hauled from New York, you can get them at your local Bostonian grocery store. Maybe there is a lot of fake lore happening on food blogs these days, and I hope so because I like good storytelling. And it's just—I
was gonna say, like, who's gonna actually call? Like, what? Okay, right, as long as you're not trying to market, like, you're not trying to take advantage of like a sob story and market to people's sympathies. You're just like, this is just a cool story about how this recipe was invented in my family that may or may not be true.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, and you also may not know if it's true or not. Like, if your mother told you this story and she pulled it out of the air, or her mom pulled it out of the air, you know. Like, this is a story we tell in our family, and we have family lore. We all have family lore.
Oh,
like that.
For sure. Yeah, that like doesn't make sense. I think that's a good bridge, though. Like, we don't talk a lot about this, but one of the major things that does get brought up when we start looking into cookbooks as a thing is the feminist angle, and how most of the time these books are written by and marketed to women, and then there's a popular conception that, you know, women are cooking, but in professional circles, the person on the cover is a guy always in a white jacket. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not so much the case anymore, but I feel like there's definitely a lot of vestiges of that feeling in cookbooks. And I'm really glad that we're moving past that for sure.
Oh, no, for sure. And just the idea of that, I mean, was pervasive, obviously. Post-World War II especially, there was a big surge in cookbooks, and I'm sure you saw that in your research,
mm-hmm.
As, you know, men were coming back from the front, you know.
Post-World War II, there was a boom in nonfiction books of all kinds, absolutely. Yeah.
And specifically, that was because, you know, the women had to transition back into the home rather than being in the factories and doing work. And there was this one advert that I saw for Hardee's, and it was just this, like, guy and this lady, like, up on her tippy toes looking out a window dreamily at her husband holding their daughter or son. It was a cartoon, and it was like, women belong in the kitchen, but if you don't have a little missus waiting for you, come down and get something sloppy and fast at Hardee's. So I haven't actually confirmed if that's a genuine advert from the time, but it made me laugh, so I wanted to share it.
Yeah.
What the F?
What the F, Hardee's?
If that's real, it's bonkers.
That's hilarious.
It did make me laugh,
though. Yeah, for sure. And a lot of the blogs that are kind of like the third or fourth wave, I don't know how we would categorize the waves of cookbook writing or recipe writing, but the blogs were written by women on the mommy blogs, essentially, on that first wave of blogging on the internet. And it's like, it's really fascinating. But now, you know, we're kind of on a different wavelength of blogs. Blogs have kind of been supplanted by social media. And if you want to, like, look up a recipe, I don't know about you, but I would usually go to, like, TikTok or something to see a video of it, or YouTube to see a video of, like, the methods for something, because that's usually what I'm looking up, is methods.
Interesting. So I tend not to get super, like, fancy when I cook. So if I were to do something like baking, I would 100% do that. Mm-hmm. Because specific, like,
yeah.
Like, we were just talking about this, actually. Thanks, Bake Show. We love you. The Great British Baking Show. Pull this out if you What's need to. What's it called? The Great British Baking Show is what we get it marketed as.
It's Bake Off.
It is Bake Off. I know. But, like, also, that's what's on Netflix.
Annie. Oh, you're right. It's different on Netflix. You're totally right. I'm sorry. Because, I was like, what is she saying?
Because.
Great British Baking Show. I got you.
Yeah. Anyway, so, but, like, for baking, those methods, like, can be very specific and you need to know. Whereas
science.
Yeah. I don't bake. Except for cookies, which we talked about, is it's a much more forgiving, like, recipe. And you can go a little bit off on, like, amounts of flour or sugar. If you use smaller or larger eggs, a little more or less milk, or different kinds of substitutions that can be made, which impact the product. It just kind of affects the texture of your dough. But especially for, like, chocolate chip cookies, something like that, you've already got other elements that are going to make it a different texture anyway. So I mostly just cook them from my heart. But I might want to know for safety purposes, like, I'm trying this particular cut of meat and I can't remember, like, what is the recommended time frame for X temperature to get to this, that's likely to get me to the safest temperature of the meat, you know, in a period of time in which my husband will then be happy to eat it.
Right, right.
And I'm also not going to murder him because I'm hungry. Mm-hmm. So, that's, like, I need that reference and I'd like to have it up just so if I forget or something, you know, by the end I'm done, you know, I, like, have it. And videos don't do that.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah, that's a little bit different. We're, like, very different types of cooks, I think. Because I always, like, I'll start with a flavor of, like, what I want. I'll, like, have that in my head. And I'm like, okay, how do I achieve that? And then I'm just, like, looking up, like, the methods for getting something the way that I want it.
That's fair.
I mean, that's just how our brains work. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's pretty normal.
I was going to say, again, like, we approach very similar things in dramatically different ways.
We truly do.
It's impressive.
So what is going on in today's cookbook stuff, Kaylee? What's up with the 2023 cookbook situation?
So I will say that some of the most interesting things that I have seen for cookbooks specifically, mm-hmm. and again, I want to be clear, I have a separate tackling of this particular topic, which was food and cooking in literature.
Yes.
But I did go ahead and do some research here onto, like, what else we use or kind of use to market our, you know, theme our cookbooks on. So themed cookbooks have really surged, not even just, like, lately, just because I think in the surge and, like, people that are wanting to connect and, like, our generation and younger generations that want to connect sort of multiple aspects of their lives and are looking for ways to sort of sort through the noise to pin down, like, okay, well, I want to try this, this, or this, when they've got so much content and so many options available to them. So themed cookbooks have probably surged as a hook to sort of say you could try this over something else because you're familiar with something about, beyond the recipes themselves, something about the cookbook is drawn in. So there's anime themed cookbooks,
mm-hmm.
that will recreate recipes from popular shows. There are, like, and that were maybe devoted to cooking or weren't devoted to cooking, but just happened to have, like, rich people in them. So you'd have, like, these episodes where, like, you'd have something. And I'm thinking, like, Oron High School, like, the show that was, like, frequently, like, the majority of their episode was set in, like, their tea room, like, after school. And so they'd always have something happening. Mm-hmm. And, like, one of their, like, the one of the guys in that was, like, rich and also, like, loved sweet things. So he'd always have, like, baked things,
I
you know?
I love that.
Yeah. So, so we have a lot of, like, those, like, themes. We also have recently, like, Hannibal had... was a pretty strongly focused with food. You will see less themed cookbooks there.
I mean, Hannibal was focused on eating people, though. Wasn't Hannibal a cannibal?
He was.
Okay.
So you wouldn't necessarily... He would change the recipes around to be for people instead of, like, you know, pork or beef or whatever. But, like, yeah, it was the food porn in a lot of these things. So, like, that's kind of a way for people to sort of hook into, like, a cookbook is, like, oh, well, I like this TV show, or I liked this movie, or I liked this genre. So there are actually very interesting, there's a Stephen King cookbook.
Interesting.
Based on his novels. Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's the Cook Like Christie, speaking of Agatha Christie.
Oh!
Yeah, there's a cookbook based on Agatha Christie's novels. Yeah.
I don't think I would want that.
I also don't think I would want that, but here we are.
For those who aren't huge Agatha Christie fans, there are multiple books of hers that are just based, like, all the food is based around, like, tinned meats, and, like, that's it. And I'm like, bro, no thank you. Yeah. But that's funny. I like it. I did get a Jane Austen cookbook for Christmas this past year. Was that from you? You're nodding like it was from you.
No, wasn't from me. I just remember that you got that, yeah.
And it was actually very good. I mean, all of the, it was, like, mostly referencing, you know, specific meals that they have in the books, but also, like, some of them were like, and this is just one that I thought would be yummy because it was around the same time. But that one was actually very good. We touched on themed cookbooks a little bit in our book packaging episode. Most themed cookbooks do come from book packagers, which does leave a little bit of a thing in there, because unless you know who is writing the cookbook, you don't always know if it's been recipe tested to, like, the highest degree, which is why one of the most popular forms of cookbooks is, like, from, you know, Serious Eats, or from, like, Williams Sonoma, or America's Test Kitchen, where they have, like, these big, well-established test kitchens that test their foods just into oblivion.
Yeah,
so
that's very fair.
So I will say that there is also a reputation for some of these where it's just not the best cookbooks, but the point is the thought of it. And it's like, I've seen the Miyazaki ones that are just look so good. And I've seen other ones like that. I do want to ask, before we get too far into this, have you ever heard of Binging with Babish? You watched Binging with
Babish?
Yeah,
I have seen. Not as many, but it is because you told me about it, so I did end up.
It's fantastic.
It was fun.
They have a new segment called Anime with Alvin. Alvin is one of the new cooks on the show, and he does almost exclusively anime things.
Fun.
It's really wonderful. That's awesome. And sometimes video games with Alvin. So lots of video games and anime on Alvin's bench in their, like, secondary kitchen. It's very good. I highly recommend Binging with Babish.
Very cool. Yeah, no, I can confirm the few episodes that I have seen have been very fun, so support that recommendation. Mm-hmm. Wholeheartedly. There are many, many other, like, so speaking of the Miyazaki, of course, the anime themed, but, like, the Sopranos, they're themed. Yeah, there are themed cooking content from that. There's themed cooking content from...
I never watched The Sopranos, but I know that it's, like, about a mafia thing, like an Italian mafia thing. I can imagine food being pretty central there. I feel like the stereotype mm-hmm. on Italians is that they're very food-focused.
Yeah, food is shown in a lot of episodes.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%. There's also, like, especially if you're looking at period content, so period mm-hmm. media, so mm-hmm. TV shows or movies, the, like, Inglourious Bastards specifically even has
really
yeah like specific recipes anyway that okay. people have assembled, so like okay. movie cookbooks will
I
include
like that.
A,
I like
a various
that.
Yeah, they'll start pulling recipes from various places, so I'll send you this article that I found from there.
I've also gotten a lot them. Of video game cookbooks, or my husband gets a lot of video game mm-hmm. cookbooks. We've got a Destiny themed cookbook, we've got a D&D themed cookbook.
Is it, can I ask, the D&D themed cookbook, is it the official one, or is it the Quincy's Tavern?
I think it's the official. I think it's the official D&D cookbook.
Okay. I totally recommend the Quincy's Tavern cookbook as well.
Yeah. Okay. What is that one about?
So Quincy's Tavern's like a podcast, and it's a D&D themed podcast, and it's just genuinely like a very cozy, the adventurers are done for the day sort of approach to
okay.
the role-playing games. And so they put a Kickstarter together to sell their cookbook where they were talking, because they would always talk about the food and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It sold like every, it tripled their campaign within like a day, like less than 12 love hours that. On Kickstarter.
I
so.
Love that.
I don't want to say like cooking is cooking, but like there are so many varieties and you can just look a recipe up online, but like mm-hmm. what makes you choose a book to buy that you have that you want to reference later. And so these, it's just, I love, I do love people.
What makes you choose a book to, like if you, you're going out, you want a cookbook, what cookbook do you want? What are you looking for?
One dish, easy.
One pot, yeah.
Limited time consumption.
Mm.
Unfortunately, like I do actually also have, like I also picked up like the Star Wars cookbook.
Did you?
Yeah, because okay. of course that was, it was really cute and I like the theme. The most recent one, actually, because I really like the Ronto wraps, actually. The
Ronto wraps, what's in them?
They're like a couple kinds of chicken and then sausage and like a coleslaw sort of thing with a spicy dressing. It's really good.
And then they're a wrap?
Yeah, it's like a wrap. Yeah, it's like a pita.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that sounds yum.
It was, that's like my favorite thing at the park.
Yeah, that sounds yum.
It's very good.
So is the book based on what's at the Disney park?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And then also there's a series of them. So there's also cookbooks that pull from like the books and the other movies and yeah.
Okay. That's cool. I like that. If they can give me like that powder that turns into bread, because that's pretty cool.
That is actually really cool.
Anyway, Kaylee, do you want me to tell you my favorite genre of cookbooks that I found?
Absolutely. Yes, please.
All right. Let me paint you a picture. All right.
Make sure that it's something we're allowed to publish.
Yes. I'm going to paint you a picture. Okay. It is 1961. You are in the Playboy Mansion.
Sounds like exactly where I would be in 1961.
It is 1961. You are in the Playboy Mansion. You are in the Playboy kitchen and you receive an order from the man himself, Mr. Hugh Hefner. And the order is for a BLT with chips, milk, applesauce, and a blonde. What do you do? You don't have to worry about it. So what these people did instead was made a cookbook about all of Hugh Hefner's favorite recipes at the Playboy Mansion and beyond, with names such as Gourmet Flapjacks for the Gentleman Griddler, Café au Lait, Peon to a Bean and its Aromatic Essence, The Beauties of the Bubbly, Champagne, the Effervescent Emblem of Liquid Luxury.
Oh my god. Although that was not bad alliteration.
The Opulent Oyster, homage to the Bacchanalian Bivalve.
Oh my god.
Currying Favor, the Sting of Satan is the Pathway to Pleasure. Which I think is a curry recipe.
I can only assume.
I have no idea. The joy that I felt when I read this, as I was just like, what the fuck, Playboy?
Oh, but Annie, you only read the recipes.
Read it for the recipes.
Of course.
I will say that this is a very 1960s cookbook where it's like, for the modern normal person, here is how you make these like super complicated in-depth French recipes that are like super fatty and just like super indulgent and rich, which maybe it's just me, but I feel like I don't eat a bunch of that kind of thing normally. Like on a normal day, I'm having like a sandwich. It's not really involving like a croque monsieur or anything like that. But it made me really happy to hear all of this. So some of the other recipes in there, just to give you a sense of what this was, are things like shad roe with almonds, chicken mousse with pistachios, frog legs poulette, lamb chops with fritto misto, that kind of thing. So it's like, it was very 1960s, and also, you know, Hugh Hefner ordered a blonde with his lunch.
Yup.
was That's just like
not surprising that that happened. Nope.
So I will say that this is probably the worst example, but it made me laugh the most. But the there are other examples of erotic cookbooks. There was actually a whole genre of these in the 1970s. Almost all of them included boobs, like pictures of just bare breasts around the around them, and they were like a. They're now coveted as like collector's items because they are so kitschy. And also, like, no one bought them, so they're just kind of sitting in shelves in places still.
Oh my gosh.
Because people, like, how would you buy that for someone? Anyway, so a lot of these books are, they feature pretty much what you would expect. Like, in the 70s, things were, like, hand-drawn. There was no computer-generated stuff, and they're just, like, hand-drawn ladies' boobs right over your, like, Oysters Rockefeller situation, just because there's a bivalve, and you know what's more bivalve than a breast, and things like that,
or something.
Yeah, but most of these were in the 1970s, when I guess gag gifts like that were more popular.
And, well, I mean, to be fair, Spencer's Gifts still exists today.
Well, what I was saying is, like, now I feel like that kind of thing would be very popular, but I think in the 1980s, for some reason, they decided that, you know, they don't like that, and it kind of fell out of favor. Gotcha. A little bit as a fad.
That makes
and
sense.
I think it probably would come back in Spencer's Gifts of today. I don't know. Is Spencer's Gifts still around?
I thought so.
Is it? Okay.
I feel like.
I haven't seen one in a while, but in fairness, I don't go to the mall ever. So.
I feel like I went the last time I did go to a mall, I must have walked by one. But also, malls are liminal spaces, so it
they
could
are.
Have been something from 1997.
Right, exactly. You walk into a mall and it could be literally any year
yeah.
ever. From the 1990s, I guess, on to today. But yeah, so a lot of them were like gag gifts. One of these was, there was a book published about the history of queer cookbooks, and it's pointing to a 1998 book called The Lesbian Erotic Cookbook as an example. Quote, written by and for women, it features recipes intended to nourish, along with photographs of the naked female bodies that reject notions of mainstream beauty standards. And I was like, that sounds awesome. Go lesbian cookbooks.
Hell yeah.
That's so cool.
Good for you.
This is another paragraph from the Eater roundup of pornographic cookbooks. Quote, self-empowerment is similarly a focus for the new generation interested in vintage cookbooks. Some of what our zine is trying to do is turn those tropes of cooking to get a husband on their heads and endorse baking for our own hedonistic pleasure instead of thinking about it as the sort of simple thing to be offered up to a husband or as a mode of seduction. Tanya Bush, a baker and co-founder of the self-published cake zine, whose first issue was called Sexy Cake, told Eater, unquote. Absolutely fantastic. I'm always in for sex positivity in general. I feel like there's a dearth of it. And especially when, as we were talking about, like, there are a lot of problematic things tied up in cookbooks and in food and in cooking in general. I think adding some levity into it is good. And I like that we both, whatever directions we picked, we did go with adding levity into that situation.
So one of the things is like, well, why do we do this as a people? Because food is so important to us, and we use food to connect with each other. Not just connect to each other, like in modern times, but to connect to our past, to inform and teach our children about our past and where we came from. And when you maybe have a more complicated relationship with your family, or you just don't have a relationship with your maybe original like blood family, if you were adopted, it can be very difficult to feel that connection. And so we strive to find that in as many ways as possible. We, you know, connect with the people that we've chosen to be our family, if, you know, your adopted family may or may not have been your tribe that you ultimately settled with. We use that across the board to, I don't want to say bookend, but to accent everything that we do. And we have both positive and negative relationships with food due to our histories, both personal and cultural. That's kind of a way that, or a reason, I should say, it's a reason behind the surge over time, the increasing surge of gastronomy in fiction, is you're using that to either say something about the culture that you're writing about, you're using it to punctuate as a writing style for meditation, you're using it as a way to engage with your characters and to connect with your characters, or you're using it as a way to connect with your readers. There are several different ways that we tend to, or that authors that are leveraging food tend to do so. And it's no real secret, in my opinion, that we had a surge during and following the pandemic in cooking-based, food-based romance novels, because they are both massive comfort buttons for us. And then setting that aside, we were also, a lot of us, locked inside during the pandemic, and a lot of people turned to food and cooking to do something with their partner to sort of connect when you couldn't necessarily leave the house regularly and you didn't want to murder them because you did still love them. And like, how do you sort of find that activity and a way to both have space and still that connection? So it's very interesting approach to like why we've had sort of this relationship with food in fiction. And so the sort of the breakdown that I just provided is actually something that was published by Adam Gopnik. Hopefully I've said his name right, in The New Yorker in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I thought was really fascinating is the gastronomy in fiction really started like to rise up and has been argued started to increase the prevalence of gastronomy in like our cultural zeitgeist with fiction in the mid-19th century. So I have some evaluation pieces about the Jeeves and Wooster like series that was...
What is it?
It's a... comedy drama.
Okay.
Comedy drama series.
All right.
By P.G. Wodehouse.
Okay.
But yeah, there's a chef in there that mm-hmm. they meet that's ethnically correct, shall we say, has the description of this particular chef, like as far as the location and the types of things that they were cooking and where they were from.
Okay.
And the way that it was described was accurate to the techniques and the food, or at least as accurate as it could be. That kind of makes sense because this series does follow a rich person and their manservant, and the shenanigans that occur is a British series that was popularized. And
this is a book series?
It was a book series that was then made into a television show.
Okay.
With Hugh Laurie as, oh, this is terrible. Very famous British actor and comedian. The worst.
It's fine.
Stephen Fry.
Oh, Fry and Laurie. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So Steve. Yes. And so I was like, the name is right there. And my, you know, just sometimes it's like when you forget how to spell the, and you're like, oh, well, I'm just stupid. Cool.
No, you're fine.
So it's just interesting to follow like how we have seen the significance of this connection rising, and you can see it. And a lot of the genres that are designed to be consumed in mass and really connect with readers, in my opinion, mm-hmm. romance novels, crime novels that are, again, you're getting a lot of things very quickly. It's really produced by the masses for the masses, generally speaking, or it's marketed for the masses. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that people want to read this. We know that people want to buy this. So let's go ahead and get that, you know, produced. Speaking of, you know, book packagers. Like, even in, like, the Boxcar Children, it's following the story. And these kids are, like, on their own. And it tells the story of, like, their instability and the scarcity that they're experiencing right now. As, you know, their parents have died. And they always heard these horror stories about their grandfather. And, like, the specific concerns that they have around food, the food that they're able to get, it all sort of speaks to that and their status and their situation and helps make that sort of relevance of fear, like, known to you as the reader.
It's kind of a visceral sort of setting, set mm-hmm. dressing, because mm-hmm. everyone understands the need for food and everyone understands the lengths you go to sometimes when to feed yourself when you don't have the money to get good food.
Yep. Yeah, so it's very interesting the way that it can, and the way that the way the food
I'm
is.
I'm sorry, my dog just stretched and did a little like think like that. Oh, so, she was so cute. Trixie. She does not care.
No.
Sorry, go ahead.
You're good. I was just gonna say, like, it tells you so much. And the writers can use food to tell you so much because food is...
it's universal.
It is, yeah. So, like, if it's something very simple and, like, the way that the character talks about it or thinks about it as they're making it can tell you so much about, like, their background or what their mood is. And again, speaking of, you know, general authorial sort of recommendations, you're going to hear a lot, show, don't tell. This is a way to do that
mm-hmm.
that is, has
good
grown
point.
Organically mm-hmm. To help set tones and moods and just fascinating, fascinating approach to, like, I just never really thought of that. One of the books that we read, you know, that I read and I recommended to you, A Wizard's Guide to Defensive Baking, the main character's like a 15-year-old baker. Like, she's a baking apprentice and she can, you know... she just wants to bake And, like, she enjoys baking, and she talks about how the ingredients sort of affect her magic in this fantasy setting. And it's just so cute. It's very sweet. And I think that authors really do a good job in, like, or they can use it to do such a good job in connecting with not only their characters, but their characters to their readers.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
We talked a little bit about how, you know, cookbooks are sort of targeted for women. Romance novels are tend to be considered for women. And
yeah,
a lot of the readership there, like some figures I've seen cited that I am attempting to follow up, you know, 20%, you know, male, about 18% are males that read romance novels, while the majority of readers are females. Again, targeted for women. And like, cooking is considered to be, even now, despite the fact that we've made great strides in feminism and equal rights and all of that, is still considered by cultural implication to be something that the woman is expected to do if a woman is involved in your relationship. And you, even if you, if no woman is involved in your relationship, say you're two self-identified men that are in a relationship and one of you does the cooking, well, you suddenly become the woman of the relationship, which is stupid and incorrect and sexist. And misogynistic even, like, and whatever, a chauvinistic, like, across the board. It's every istic and ism.
Patriarchal.
across the board.
Horrible.
So it's very, it is very interesting to sort of consider the positives and the negatives of the associations with the genres, yeah, that it's important in.
It's one of those things where we can't change it. You know, this is the way the world is based on so many historical factors that have nothing to do with us. But we are here now, and we can at least revel in the parts that make us happy.
Yeah, and then continue to work on the things that don't. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Enjoy what you enjoy, guys. Like, don't feel, like, shamed because you like cozy cooking romances or crime and dime novels about, like, a detective who loves food and also solves murders. You know, like, again, it tells you, like, something about the detective. It's giving you knowledge. It doesn't even matter. If that's just your thing, enjoy it. Like, don't feel that something is less worthy because it is a trope or a trend. Like, it's just fun. What's fun? And there's so few things sometimes that we can enjoy when everything's going wrong. So enjoy what you enjoy.
Thank you for listening to The Ink Sink. I am Annie.
I'm Kaylee.
And if you want to follow us or stalk us or scroll with our content in your feed, you can absolutely do that. You can find our Facebook and Instagram links, and as well as the various links to all the various podcasting apps on our Linktree. There you can also find a link to our bookshop page. If you want to support diverse voices, we recommend that you buy books from diverse authors and support their art. You can find our list of books by trans authors, as well as books by breakout Latina authors, on our bookshop page. Those are going to be at the top of our list.
We should put together a bookshop list for cookbooks from minority authors.
Ooh, we should. Yes. Okay. And we are going to be, as we release this episode, putting together a list of cookbooks that we love from minority authors, and we hope that you like that too. Thank you for listening.